French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey, y'all, welcome back to the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. We're glad you're here giving this episode a listen. We are in the full swing of hunting season across the Great Plains, and I know I'm very excited about that. I know I've heard a lot of great stories of folks out successfully, you know, shooting their first rooster across the Great Plains or harvesting a great deer. Love hearing it. Love that we are in the thick of hunting season. And we're going to talk about a very important component today about hunting, and that's access. Rob, I know you and I have had and continue to have many discussions around access, and very excited for our guests to be with us today to talk more about that here across the Great Plains and specifically in Kansas.
Yeah, you bet, Brittany. I think we've talked about how hunting access just across the Great Plains in general, especially in Kansas, it can be real tricky. You know, most of the lands east of the Rocky Mountains are privately held, and hunting is becoming more and more commercialized with outfitters and land being leased. I know, in my youth, it wasn't a big deal to stop and knock on doors, and you were probably going to get access maybe just for that day. Mm-hmm. But a lot of folks, sure, you can hunt the season, wasn't a big deal. And that's just not the case anymore. And I know that having access is one of the leading barriers that's been identified to people that either are going to take up hunting or stay active in hunting, or even, you know, pick it up again after they've maybe set down their rifle or their shotgun for a while. So, and I think it's important too for our listeners to remember that all the wildlife across the United States is owned by the statehood at large. So in Kansas, for example, all the deer and the turkeys and the quail and the pheasants, they belong to every one of the state residents. And the landowners do not own that wildlife, but they can control the access to the public or people who can be on their land and access that wildlife while it happens to be on the public land.
Yeah, that could be like a whole another podcast we get into and probably should at some point. I think that's incredibly important. And one other thing to echo on there is, you know, access is not just an issue for the Great Plains, Kansas specific. I mean, it's a conversation that's had at national level across the entire U.S. You know, I go to conferences and I hear folks from all these different game and fish DNR operations, and that's the same thing. You know, that's what they're talking about. How can we do better? How do we provide access? How do our hunters and anglers, you know, gain access? And so I think it's always great to have continued conversations around that. So let's get into it with Brian today. We've got Brian Sherpon on the podcast with us today, and he works for the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks as the Public Lands Regional Supervisor for Northwest Kansas. Brian is based out of Hayes, America, and supports 8 public lands managers who enhance habitats, manage wildlife, and enforce laws on wildlife areas, state fishing lakes, and other public lands from Saline County north to Nebraska and west to Colorado. It's a pretty big territory. If you're familiar with Kansas, it's essentially the northwest corner, and that's a lot of land over there. He also oversees a statewide special hunts program, works with partner organizations to achieve shared goals, and works on land donations and acquisitions in his region. Brian has been in his role since August of 2022 and has previously worked in a variety of capacities for Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks, South Dakota Game and Fish and Parks, and Pheasants Forever. Brian, thanks for joining us on the podcast. We're excited to kind of get into the weeds with you here a little bit. But first, you know, tell us about yourself and how you kind of got started in the outdoors.
Sure. Well, thank you. You know, first of all, thank you for the introduction and certainly for the invitation to talk to you today. I guess a couple things you should know about me before we get started, especially with relation to a podcast.
Yeah.
Number one, this is my first podcast. Don't hold it against me.
All right.
And then the second thing would be, I like to tell stories, and I do sometimes have a tendency to ramble. So if I get long-winded or anything, please feel free to cut me off. You're not going to offend me. But I don't want to take too long on something if we need to cover a bunch of information. Just a couple things, I guess. You talked about expanding on the introduction a little bit. Some things that you might not glean from, my short generic job description would be, I'm originally from Kansas. I'm from between Hays and Great Bend originally. And, some people will call it Central Kansas. Some people call it Western Kansas. Depends on who you talk to. But I really appreciate the area. I think it's kind of underrated, which maybe sometimes that's a good thing because you don't get as much pressure as some other parts of the state. But I really like this, and I'm glad to be back. As you mentioned, I've worked for some other agencies and in different areas, and I'm glad to be back home. I'm glad to be back near family and everything else. I do have a wife, and I've got two young daughters. I've got a 5-year-old, and as of the week that we are recording this, I will have a 1-year-old as well. So,
love it.
Yeah, as you can imagine, they keep us on our toes and provide a lot of really good opportunities to teach and to get, you know, them outdoors. Of course, maybe not so much the 1-year-old yet, but the 5-year-old can get out and do a lot of things, and she loves to be outdoors with me. Up until recently, we've had a coonhound, and I think now this is the first time in about 13 or 14 years I haven't had a coonhound, but we do have a German Shorthair, which would be my first real bird dog, and we've had him for 2 years. This will be his second season, and I'm excited to get him out. And I'm like you and most of our constituents. I'm a user of the resource as well, and I like to hunt and fish, and I used to trap quite a bit, but haven't done that for quite a while now, at least not very intensely anyway. But I like to get out, so it's really nice to be able to combine those interests and those passions that I have on a personal level with what I'm doing professionally, and hopefully folks understand and appreciate that's most of us who work for wildlife and parks are users of the resource, and we want to see things succeed just as much as they do.
I love that. So how did you, Brian, find yourself in the role you're in today? I'm curious. I know you have some tenure in the outdoors, obviously, but this is a pretty big job. And just curious on what you're loving about it or how you found yourself in that role today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've listened to other folks kind of give biographies, and it's always kind of weird to talk about yourself. And I know some folks have a really winding path and some people have a straight path, and I'm probably somewhere in between. I grew up, like I said, between Hays and Great Bend, a pretty rural area. In fact, my graduating class had 18 to 20 people, and it was all so pretty small in the grand scheme of things. But that really afforded me the opportunity to be outdoors a lot. And I grew up hunting, fishing, trapping. We had a very small family farm operation, but we had a farm, and we were out, and we had some cattle and some cropland, some alfalfa, and I guess I'll give a shout out now maybe to my dad. My dad doesn't have a college degree or anything like that, but he spent so much time outdoors that he just knew things, And when we were out, whether it was farming or hunting or anything else, he would quiz me on stuff and be really interactive. What was that sound? Well, it was a northern cardinal. What's that over there? Maybe it's a brown thrasher. Maybe it's a mule deer. What's the difference between a mule deer and a white-tailed deer? And we'd go over some of that stuff. Even cleaning animals, like we'd look at the organs and different things. Well, this is the heart, these are the lungs, and so on. And having that background and having that interaction all the time really instilled that passion for the outdoors and the natural world in me. I think it's in all of us. I think we all really appreciate nature, some more than others, obviously, but that really helped develop what I would later decide to do in my life. Ultimately, I decided to go to Fort Hays, which is close to home. And at the time, I didn't know that there was anything besides a game warden. So that was kind of my career goal going into college, was I was going to be a game warden. And I quickly found out that there was a whole world of opportunity besides just a game warden position. And I worked as a seasonal throughout college for a fisheries biologist in Northwest Kansas. So I was our main office was in Cedar Bluff, and then we went all the way up to Nebraska and West Colorado from there, and covered all the fisheries out there, and did clinics and stocked ponds and did sampling and everything. And so I really fell in love with that management aspect of things at the time, and being able to make a difference, you know, change something, see what we would perceive as an issue or something that maybe wasn't quite what met our goals, and being able to make a change and then see how that change affected, in this case, the fishery. And so I really enjoyed that. I ended up finishing my bachelor's degree in wildlife biology, went on to get a master's degree in fisheries biology, also from Fort Hays. And, you know, at the time I finished my master's, I got married. And my wife was in another town pursuing her education. And so, job or not, I decided I needed to be with my wife. And I've been very blessed and very fortunate over the years to have followed her around and still been able to find jobs that were related to what I wanted to do. So I moved out to Salina at the time, and I worked a little bit with the Conservation District and the Natural Resource Conservation Service. And then a position opened up with Kansas Wildlife and Parks. And I was fortunate enough to get that position as a private lands biologist. And so I worked with private landowners and the public in Saline and Ottawa counties, and a little bit into Cloud County and, you know, some of the surrounding areas, but primarily Saline and Ottawa counties. Did some bigger events and things out there, all the surveys and habitat planning for private landowners there. Oversaw the walk-in hunting program in that area. And we thought we were going to be in Salina for a long time. Life happens, and it didn't work out that way, and we ended up moving to South Dakota. And so we were actually in Sioux Falls, South Dakota for a year, and for most of that year, I was actually a stay-at-home dad. We had our first child there, and then we moved to Fort Pierce, South Dakota. And if you're familiar with South Dakota at all, Pierce is the capital. Fort Pierce is just right across the Missouri River. It's a really neat area, and for anybody that likes the outdoors, it's probably one of the and I'm partial to Kansas, I'm biased to Kansas, but it's probably one of the best areas in the country to live for outdoor pursuits, because there's fishing, there's waterfowl hunting, there's big game hunting, there's upland hunting, there's just everything right in that area. And I was again fortunate enough to acquire a position with South Dakota Game Fish and Parks. And I was the wildlife regional program manager for the wildlife program there. I oversaw a resource biologist who did all of the disease, all of the surveys, all of the biology in the region, program assistant who worked on waterfowl hunting access and some other things. He did surveys and stuff as well, right there around that pier area. And then I had seven wildlife damage specialists who worked all across my region, which covered from North Dakota down to Nebraska, either side of the Missouri River. And they worked with the public, landowners, producers on, you know, human wildlife conflicts. And that was a very good position. I enjoyed it very much. It was kind of similar in some ways to what I'm doing now, not the public land side of things, but just the fact that I was doing a lot of different things. And that was really neat. I then, we moved back to Kansas and I started working for Pheasants Forever, and I worked in the Smoky Hills, working with private landowners and producers to try and protect and enhance the prairie and grasslands in this region, primarily through the Great Plains Grassland Initiative. And I won't get into too much on that right now, but that was also very good. And I really appreciated the fact that a lot of people are working on grassland restoration, enhancement, and just trying to save them. But through all this time, and this is not meant to be an insult to any other agency or anywhere else that I work, but wildlife and parks is home. And I really enjoy, at the time I enjoyed, and now I enjoy working for the agency. And so I was looking for a job with wildlife and parks, and this position became available. And if anybody's familiar with Mike Nyhoff, he had the position before me, and he left some pretty big shoes to fill, and a lot of institutional knowledge that he had. And I was very fortunate to get this position. Like we mentioned in the introduction, I've been here a little over a year. I'm still learning a lot. I'm still trying to figure everything out, but it has been just a really cool path, even over the last year or so, just learning what all we do and how much everybody really cares about the resource and about the people who are benefiting from that.
Brian, I appreciate, the Wildlife and Parks was home to you, and I appreciate hearing that, that you like working there, right? I mean, that environment is someplace that you want to be, being a taxpayer and an outdoorsman and somebody who uses public lands. I'm glad you're not like, man, I can't wait to get out of this toxic environment or something like that. So I'm curious, you played those other roles. So you're a public lands, make sure I get the right, public lands regional supervisor. So we talked about the region. But what does that mean in Kansas, public lands? Like, what percentage of the land in Kansas, or maybe just in your region, if you know that off the top of your head, is actually public lands? And before we started recording, we started talking a little bit about WEHA versus public land and like how those are different from one another. And you mentioned that you had been on the private land side, so you've got some pretty good insight into that. And so I think that's important. You know, you hear that statistic where people are like, well, Kansas has very little public land, but we have WEHA. So yeah, it's kind of like, but, you know, that's kind of our saving, you know, but it's not exactly public land. There's certain things you can do or can't do. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about that. And then just, you know, you had a role in South Dakota. So on the greater scheme of things, you had a larger scope, mostly across the Great Plains. What is the public land access percentage sort of like, at least from your view?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start. There's some really good information that our assistant division director, and actually now he's currently the acting division director of public lands, Ryan Stuckey, he gave at a commission meeting in September. And it kind of addressed some of this question about what percentage of Kansas is public, how much of it is open to public access for hunting. Because there's some numbers that get thrown around a lot, and I'm not sure that we always understand what those numbers really mean. When it comes to the entire United States, Kansas is pretty much at the bottom for the amount of public land. Different sources will tell you different things. Usually we're listed as somewhere between 47th and 49th in the country, as far as the amount of public land or the amount of public land in relation to the state. Usually it seems like Rhode Island is listed as last, but if you're familiar with Rhode Island, it's not a very big state versus Kansas. And so the fact that we have so little public land, I think that really means something. And so the number that gets thrown around a lot is about 98%. 98% of Kansas is privately owned. And while that might be approximately true, and I think that's about right. The number that I have from Ryan's presentation is about 98.1% is privately owned. That doesn't mean that 2% that's supposedly public is open to access, whether that's hunting or other types of access. That 2% is military installments. That 2% are public roads, you know, that maybe KDOT or other entities own. Some of that is municipalities or county-owned lands and parks. So not all of that is actually open to public. When it comes to what Kansas Wildlife and Parks either owns or manages, and so we do have lands that we manage that we don't own that are open to public access. And generally speaking, most of those are federally owned. In the northwest part of the state, most of those are owned by the Bureau of Reclamation. And then throughout most of the rest of the state, and then we do have a couple up here as well that are owned by the Army Corps of Engineers. And we have agreements with those federal entities to manage some of those areas for hunting and other recreational pursuits. But by and large, when we're looking at those, you know, federal properties that we manage and then all of the properties that we own, it looks like we have about, of that 1.9%, 31% of that are land acres that we manage. So of the total, it's about 0.6%. When you include water acres, which would be the main bodies of reservoirs primarily, we're at 0.87% of the state's land in Kansas is open for public access. So very, very small amount.
Yeah, not much.
And so because of that, of course, that is why the walk and hunting program is such a big deal, because those are privately owned lands that the state leases for hunting access. And I think the most recent numbers that I have is just a little over 1 million acres of land in Kansas is leased through the walk and hunting access program. And it varies. It'll go up and down. You know, we'll lose contracts some years and then we'll gain contracts some years. It usually, for the last several years, has hung out around 1 million acres. I don't know what the percentage is when you include walk and hunting. I think it probably pushes it close to 3% or so, maybe a little less than that, but I'm not 100% sure. So, I mean, I'd say don't quote me, but we're on a podcast, so everybody will hear this. But yeah, that walk and hunting access program is a really big deal. And, you know, if anybody is listening to this and wants to find out more about that specific program or they want to enroll, they can find all of that out through their local wildlife biologist. And if you're not sure who that is, you can find that on our website. In fact, most of the time you could probably search on your favorite search engine of choice, Kansas Wildlife Biologist, and it'll probably come up, on our website. You know, find a biologist and there's a map and you can click on it. It'll tell you who your local biologist is. You know, you kind of ask a lot of questions and how does Kansas compare to, you know, we talked about the overall country, but how does that compare to other states in the Great Plains? And, you know, a lot of the Great Plains is private, you know, they're privately owned states primarily. Agriculture is a big deal. I think in Kansas, something like 88% of the state's land is reported to USDA as ag land. And there's some land that's not reported to USDA. So there's probably even more agricultural land or idle land that could be ag included in that percentage. When I was in South Dakota, if I remember correctly, it's about 85% privately owned. And same thing, though, that doesn't mean that 15% is open to public access. And a large portion of the reason, or a large portion of that 15%, and the reason why it's bigger than Kansas, would be like the Black Hills, and some of those federal properties in the western part of the state that almost end up more like the western states, like Wyoming and Montana and states like that. I'm not really sure on the percentages for like Iowa, Nebraska, Oklahoma, but I know that they have more public land than we do, but it's still a pretty low number overall in the grand scheme of things.
Sure. So, but you touched on Weehaw just a little bit, and I want to make sure that I've got it right. And that our listeners understand, we talk about walk-in hunting access. You're talking about lands, private lands that the state of Kansas is leased through their Weehaw program for hunting access. So if I want to take my kids on a camp out, that's not a activity that's permitted. Even if I just want to take my dog for a walk and not be in a hunting activity, say it's even out of season, the way I understand it, that's not permitted. But is that the case?
That would be correct. In fact, access to those lands is not allowed outside of the contract period. And so if you were to roll up on a walk-in hunting access property, and they will have signs on them, and those signs that say Weehaw across them will give you a time frame that is open for hunting access. Most of those are going to be September through January, November through January, September to May, something like that. And so if it's July, nobody should be accessing that property anyway without permission from the landowner. And we really don't encourage folks to be reaching out to those landowners, because sometimes that's why those producers have put their land into walk-in hunting, is just so that they don't have people calling them and bugging them all the time. And yeah, there are restrictions. Most of the walk-in hunting should have regulation signs up as well that tell you, generally speaking, what is and is not permitted on those properties. Camping is not permitted on those properties. Target shooting is not permitted on those properties. Technically, you're not supposed to forage, so you're not supposed to hunt mushrooms or anything else on a walk-in hunting access program property. Those properties are solely for hunting, and they're also just, I probably shouldn't have to say this, but I know over my years working with wildlife and parks that some people don't understand the walk-in part of things either. And if there's an open gate, there are some folks that are liable to drive in.
Or a closed driving, gate.
Yeah, driving is not permitted on these properties either. This is for walk-in access. So you might have to park on the road. You might not be real comfortable with it, but...
that's even, you know, to get your animal out, right? You walk in,
right,
and harvest a whitetail. That means you have to walk the harvest out.
That's exactly right. And I know some people don't like that, and... maybe sometimes it seems silly, especially if there's an access road or something or a trail that goes through. But we are trying to do what we can to keep, you know, those landowners and producers happy so they stay in the program. And if there's a bunch of people driving across their property, people have removed their properties from walk-in hunting for less. So we want to do what we can to certainly respect the land and respect the landowners, and make sure that, you know, we keep things clean and we obey those rules so that we continue to have access. Otherwise, you know, without the walk-in hunting access program and those properties, we're going to be hurting pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. So back on the public land side, I mean, what kind of your role now, before we started recording, we started talking about some of the areas that you manage and you threw out there, like Norton's Lake up there and Webster over by Stockton and Cedar Bluff. So I know a lot of those lakes, and especially I'm in the eastern side of the state, you know, you hear this thrown around a lot, like, that's a core lake, that's a core engineer's lake, you know, whether it's Council Grove or Milford or whatever. Okay, so talk a little bit about that. So, you know, you got state lands and core lands, and federally we talked about the Cimarron grasslands, which is public lands, right? But it's not something that you manage. It's out of your area, but it's also a federal area. And so kind of what's that nuts and bolts and screws and washers of public lands in Kansas?
Sure. Well, I'd like to say it's an easy answer. but it's really, it's not. I mean, it's kind of complicated depending on where you are. And so for this north central and northwest part of the state, primarily we've got two main federal entities that own lands that we might manage. Those would be the Bureau of Reclamation and then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And so the Corps of Engineers properties in this part of the state would be Wilson and then Kannapolis. And the Bureau of Reclamation properties would be like Norton, Webster, Cedar Bluff, Glen Elder, Lovewell. So in some instances, and this would be all across the state, right? In some cases, there are federally owned properties that are federally managed. In some places, there are federally owned properties that are state managed. In some cases, there are federally owned properties that are a combination of state or federally managed. And then there are state owned properties that are state managed. And so, for example, the grasslands, those are owned by the U.S. Forest Service, actually, and those are federally managed. But then we could look in my own region at Kerwin, and that is a Bureau of Reclamation owned property that is primarily managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Other than the state agency, us, we manage the fishery. So we've got three different entities involved with that particular property. And then, like I said, most of these other ones, for example, there might be at Webster, there might be a federally owned portion of that we manage. And also part of it might be state owned that we manage. So there's a lot of combinations, and we work with our federal partners to make sure we are accomplishing their goals as well as ours. And we might have to get special approvals to do certain things. But we're trying to all work together to provide that access for the public.
I would say you guys do a really good job with that too, Brian. We, you know, through Outdoor Mentors, utilize some of the leftover special hunts and certainly try to use public land access as much as we can, but also work with the Corps of Engineers. And it's really neat to watch those relationships that you mentioned get balanced out for the greater good, which is access. And so I echo and I applaud you all for doing the work you do, because I mean, we get kids out on some pretty unique hunts because of those relationships you all have built and managed.
Sure, absolutely. And you know, some of these places have different goals, and some of our partners have different goals than we do, but generally speaking, we can make it work, and yeah, we can meet everybody's goals. Even if, you know, let's say a certain area might be set up for irrigation or agriculture or something else, we can still typically use that for fishing or hunting access and manage those in such a way that everybody kind of gets what they need.
Mm-hmm. So Brian, I'm curious, you know, we talked about the area that you manage, and no doubt you could just kind of fold that over into the rest of the state, and there are other managers and supervisors that are taking care of those areas. So if we, you know, we replicate that, what is the term management? What are you even talking about? Right. So, it's got to be funded, obviously. And like, where does that come from? And then once you take that funding, what do you do with it? Like, I think about, okay, you know, there's a boat ramp, and a vault toilet at the boat ramp, and maybe a campground, and, you know, the little brown signs that say, you know, you have to have a permit to park here. But I'm sure it's way more than that, but you know, at the surface, you know, think about, okay, yeah, here's a piece of acreage next to a lake or whatever, and there's public access. But what does management, what are we even talking about?
Sure. Well, it's funny, because I think it was before we started recording, Brittany kind of joked that this would be part one of a 5-part series. And there would be no way for me to fully explain what all we do and where the funding comes from in just, you know, a short period of time. But I guess what I would say, just really quick, so let's look at the funding part of things, where the budgets are. And, you know, we have funding sources. It's just as complicated as who manages what and where and when, because we have the typical wildlife fee funds, which are monies from our license sales and permits. And we try to minimize that as much as we can, but we have to use those monies for some of our management. We have various grants and other funding sources through like PR, Pittman Robertson dollars, or you know, wildlife restoration type activities, just like, you know, a lot of our other divisions have. And even just talking about all the different divisions that we have within wildlife and parks would take quite a bit of time, but you know, I probably won't have time to go over how those Pittman Robertson dollars really work exactly, but you know, that's where some of our funding comes from, is PR and other grants, other federal grants that we try to get access to. We do get some fisheries money because we, Public Lands, our division does oversee management of some of our state fishing lakes, like Sheridan State Fishing Lake, which would be out by Hoxie, Ottawa State Fishing Lake, which is over by Bennington, and Minneapolis there. So we do get a little bit of fisheries money in that way. And then we also have ag budgets, which if you've been to some of these wildlife areas, Cedar Bluff, Webster, Norton, or even in the eastern part of the state, a lot of them have farm ground. Some of those areas we farm, but a lot of those areas we actually contract with local producers we will plan it and come up with an agricultural plan that will benefit wildlife. And so then it might be on a cash rent basis or it might be on a shares basis, but we will get paid through agriculture. Through harvest or just different activities that are done on those lands. And that's complicated too, because there are federal ag budgets and then there are state ag budgets. And depending on the federal agency, on a federal ag budget, sometimes we're able to use those monies just on that property. Sometimes we're able to use them on other ones within that same federal entity on those properties. Sometimes we can't actually use those monies directly. We have to have abatements to where we are paying our producers to actually either do the work or contract the work out, but we don't actually ever see the money. And if those monies don't get used, a lot of times they go back to like the federal treasury. And so, yeah, it's not an easy answer, but that's kind of the really kind of general overview of the budget themselves. But yes, what does management really look like?
But before you jump off the funding, yeah. I want to, you know, one thing I'm not hearing you say is that I'm not going to buy groceries or some other item, household item, and paying sales tax that's funding your budget. I'm not paying property tax that's funding your budget, and those taxes that go to the state house are not part of the general budget that the governor puts together and has to be approved. So, so the idea like, hey, these are my lands. Yes, they're public lands, right? But, you know, I'm paying for these lands. Why aren't they taking better care of whatever? Like, now it, you could argue, I suppose, that the sales tax on, it's not a sales tax, the Pittman Robertson tax on ammunition, firearms, those types of things. But on the flip side, we see that like Missouri has, I think it's at like 0.125-cent sales tax, a true sales tax that goes to conservation. And man, they have some pretty amazing facilities when you go around some of Missouri state parks and wildlife areas and things. So I just want to make that, you know, if I've got that right, that you're not taking quote unquote tax dollars and using them in your budget, and your budget's not being allocated by the state house.
Well, yeah, so that's pretty much correct. And it's a common misconception that folks have, and we get comments like that a lot, you know, well, I pay my taxes, so you should listen to me. Right. And we don't get tax money, but we're still going to listen. We're still going to hear you out. And you know, different people have different ideas of what we should do. And so we can't please everybody. We're never going to make everybody happy.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, that's not to say that we never ask for tax money. There might be special projects or things like that that we might ask for it. Very rarely do we actually get that. And I don't think we've gotten anything for a number of years. I don't know anything off the top of my head, to be honest, that we've actually gotten tax money for. We're pretty much 100% self-funded. Now, that being said, you know, the legislature, they do still, or the state itself does oversee our budget. So even though we're fee funded through license fees and PR dollars and things like that, we still do get allocations on our money from the legislature. And so they will set up and say, yeah, you can spend this much money, or no, you can't spend this much money, and so on. So they do have a little bit of control over our budget, even though it's not really tax money. But by and large, we are able to use our money wisely and hopefully accomplish those goals to keep at least the majority of folks happy and benefit the resource primarily. We're not getting tax money.
Wildlife and Park Christmas party in Vegas or anything like that.
If only, right? Yeah. nothing like that. And you know, we try to be pretty frugal as well. Sometimes we have to make purchases, and sometimes we want to do what we can to have, for example, equipment that's going to help us better the resource. I mean, you know, sometimes a 1960s tractor is just not going to be as efficient as you know, a newer tractor, but we will hold on to things for as long as we can a lot of times. But yeah, we try to be pretty frugal. We try to use our money wisely and in such a way that we can have the biggest impact as we can.
So when we see Mr. Nyhoff, we tell him that you guys hold on to things just as long as you can.
Yeah, there you go.
he finally, you guys had to upgrade and he had to retire. You'd held on to him as long as you were going to.
Yeah, I'm not going to speak to anything like that. But yeah,
Mike's a great guy.
You can certainly give him a little bit of a hard time.
Only fair we give Mike Nyhoff a hard time. Love that guy.
But yeah, so I mean, yeah, we're not getting tax money or anything, but we do try to listen to what folks have to say. And of course, in the age of the internet, everybody's an expert on things. Mm-hmm. And that does make things tough sometimes, but yeah, we're doing the best that we can with what we have. And we are sometimes limited on monies and resources, but I feel like, you know, especially when we get comments from other folks, non-residents and things that tell us that we're doing a good job, that really helps. And it makes us feel like we are, not to compare us to other states or anything, but you know, we're overall, I think we're doing a pretty good job to give people access, and it's not just about access, right? We're also just trying to improve the habitat and what is available for wildlife, both, you know, game, you know, sport wildlife that we can hunt, but also non-game wildlife almost always benefits from the management that we're doing out there.
So some of that manager, I think I got you off track. You know, we were talking about boat ramps and vault toilets, or sure. I was, but what, you know, what is that, you know, you're talking about trying to improve the habitat. So is that,
well, and I'll get back to that too, but you're not wrong either, because we do deal with, on the public land side of things, which parks deals with this a lot too, but we do have boat ramps and we do have toilets and we do have these, we have campsites. Most of our campsites are not like the parks campsites where they have electricity and utilities and things, but we do have those camping areas and things that, we try to maintain for folks to use both during the summer when they're trying to fish and camp and hike. But also, I mean, a lot of folks will use these campsites during deer season, and they'll have deer camp or duck camp and things in these sites. And we are not just dealing with the habitat. We do that too, and that's our One of our primary goals is to manage the habitat, but we also have that infrastructure, and we have fences and roads. We're trying to maintain roads and maintain those boat ramps and buildings and shelter houses and things like that as well. But yeah, I guess getting back to the habitat side of things, you know, that entails a lot of different activities as well. So, you know, one of the things that's just really easy to talk about, especially in a prairie state, is we burn, and we try to have prescribed fire on our properties. And, you know, we're in this part of the state where we don't always get a lot of rain. And we do get a lot of wind. So we're not always able to burn as much as we might like, or we can't burn, you know, the different properties all, you know, as often as we want either. But we do what we can to try and, you know, set back some of that ecological succession. And for the folks that don't really know what that means, is we're basically trying to keep the grassland as a grassland. We don't necessarily want a forest all over these areas. And that doesn't mean we get rid of all the trees everywhere completely. You know, we try to have some of those savanna areas and those riparian areas around the creeks and wet areas that have, you know, some trees and beneficial shrubs and things like that. But we are big proponents of burning, and we try to do that and keep some open ground, keep some forbs and wildflowers and things out there on the landscape, not let things get dominated by trees and thick grasses all the time. So that would be one aspect of management. We do a lot of agriculture, right, where we try to plant cover crops. We try to harvest things in a way that's not going to affect nesting and brood rearing from our upland birds and things of that nature. We try to plant wildlife-friendly varieties of crops. We try to even just have our timing and our crop rotations in such a way that it's beneficial to the wildlife. Sometimes we'll, in certain areas like Glen Elder, we'll do things on a rotation where we don't normally plant a lot of soybeans, but you know, a prior soybean field is a really good place to plant grass and get it converted back to grassland. And so Chris, our manager up there, he does a lot of that, where he'll have an area that when he wants to convert it, it's kind of a unusual thing for the producer that helps us out to be able to plant soybeans. But he'll say, all right, you can plant soybeans for a year, 2 years, whatever it is. And then at the end of that, we're going to actually take that out of production and put it into grass, because that's what we're really missing in this area. Besides just the agricultural side and the burning side, we do have equipment to mow, to mulch trees, to cut trees, to move trees. We do a lot of that. We spray, try and get rid of thistles and invasive species. We deal a lot with invasive species. Phragmites is a big one in this area. And these things will just take over an area, and we try to prevent that. We don't want a big monoculture of something, and we try to be good neighbors. We try to make sure that these things are not getting out to everyone else and causing issues out there. And then, you know, one of the things that we haven't really talked about, but is probably one of the major, or maybe it's an unsung hero of management, I guess, is law enforcement. And we're not game wardens. They primarily work on private lands, and they do a lot of really good work. And they do help on public lands. I don't want to say that they don't do that at all. But almost all of our public lands managers are law enforcement certified. And so we do law enforcement on our public lands, and we will help counties out and other folks that need help. And we try to provide that safety aspect and make sure we're not just managing the habitat side of things, but we're also trying to make sure that people are using that resource in such a way that we can all enjoy it for years to come. And also, we do have several, you know, I said that most of us are LE certified, and we are, but we have a lot of non-LE certified public lands managers, and I don't want to take anything away from them, because they are awesome, and they do, you know, just as much work. They're out there on opening days and stuff too, doing surveys and just being a presence out there. So we've got just, I can't say enough about our managers who are actually on the ground doing the work and planning and working with contractors and doing everything. They, I almost wish we could have a whole podcast just dedicated to highlighting these folks and what they do. But, yeah, we have a lot of different things that we're trying to work on, through public lands, and our managers just do a really awesome job, getting things done.
That was one thing I wanted to really hit on too. So I'm glad you mentioned that, Brian, is there are so many moving pieces and people, in this snippet of descriptions you're giving and how we manage public lands in Kansas. And those managers do an incredible job, and they're just great people. I know I've talked to so many of them across the state, whether it's about scouting a property to get a youth out hunting, or, you know, questions about what opportunities could be in the future, right? They're all very excited and eager to be a service. And it's sometimes a thankless job, I can imagine. So here's a very formal thank you if you are a public lands manager, and to you, Brian, for what you do, so all of us can have that access and opportunity.
No, we really appreciate that. And there's so much that I didn't even have a chance to talk about that those guys do and gals do out there in the field. And we do get some thank yous occasionally. We also get a lot of negative comments. So it's always nice to get a thank you and to hear that appreciation. I know if any of the folks in my area listen to this, they'll appreciate that very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Brian, it sounds like we probably need to try to schedule some time, you know, maybe one or two more podcasts ahead, because yes, we haven't even talked about special hunts, and that's a whole other topic that I think is definitely worthy of a podcast. But to start to wrap this one up, we always do a lightning round, which is just 8 lighthearted questions, you know, quick, easy answers, this or that, yes or no. So if you're game for that, I may jump in and start out with some lightning round questions for you.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, we talked a little bit about in your introduction, you were talking about, you know, basically being a lifelong outdoorsman, and you live out on, that questionable whether it's Western or Central Kansas, but it's grassland. I grew up not far from you, so I understand that dilemma, right? Anyway, question number one. Your ideal, let's say late November morning, are you going to be out on a prairie grassland or on a wetland playa area?
I'll be on the grassland. That's not to take away from the wetlands. And I really, should probably hunt waterfowl more than I do, but I'll be on the grassland, especially with the short hair that I've got now.
Okay. Question number two, you know, Kansas, it's funny. I always thought of Kansas as a sunset state. Everybody talks about the beautiful Kansas sunsets, whatever. And recently we were in South Florida down at Clearwater, and they had a pier, and it was like the best sunsets in the world, you know. And then we were in coastal Oregon a couple years ago, and everybody there was like, oh, we have the absolute best sunsets, you know. And I'm like, wait a minute, I thought that was a Kansas thing. But
that's not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you guys can't have it. But out on the prairie where you live, do you, I don't want to say appreciate, but which one's your favorite, the Kansas sunsets or the sunrises? So maybe that's, are you a morning or an evening person? I don't know.
Well, you know, I think that's changed over time, because at one time it would have been all about sunsets, but there's something, I would say now it's sunrises, and there's just something special about being up when nobody else is up.
Yeah.
And especially if it's before the sunrise even starts, and just hearing everything come to life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it might be the owls, and then the coyotes, and then the cows, and then the quail, and just everything wakes up and blows up. And especially on a really nice day, you'll get that sun coming up, and it's just golden and it's beautiful. And so, yeah, I would say sunrises right now.
Okay, perfect. So number three, you kind of segued right into it. You talked about listening to the quail whistling. You're on that sunrise grassland prairie hunt. Are you trying to target rooster pheasants or bobwhites?
Quail, bobwhite. Yep. And again, that maybe that's somewhat a product of circumstance, because pheasants aren't, you know, the population hasn't been real great for a little while, but there's just something about quail being a native species and how they, mm-hmm. they blow up in front of you and give you a heart attack that you just you really have to enjoy.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. I can appreciate that. Okay. So the same trip, it's a, like I said, a late November, Saturday sunrise hunting quail. It's getting close to lunchtime. Are you going to stop at that small town cafe, or are you looking for that menu that you know, the franchise, same, you know, it's funny because I travel with some people and they're like, well, we got to go to McDonald's because I know they always have the right hamburger, or Freddy's, or Derek, you know, whatever. And then other people are like, man, I want to go see what the little local watering hole or cafe or whatever. So which boat are you in?
Well, if I'm being honest, most of the time I probably just bring a lunch or granola bar.
Okay.
To eat. But if I had to choose between those two, it's going to be the local place every time. It's not that I don't ever eat at a chain restaurant or something, but no, I like to see what everybody has to offer. And there's just some really cool, mm-hmm. I don't want to say hole in the wall, but just some really obscure places out there that you would never know existed if you didn't walk in and try it. And they're really good.
And they're probably the beating heart of that community, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, like I said, I live west of Hayes, and there's so many small towns out here that, boy, you just need to go out and try all these places, because they're the heart and soul of the town, and they're very much underappreciated.
Yep.
Cool. Okay. Number five, we're going to change our hunt up a little bit, and you have to pick, or maybe not. Late season, so let's say it's after Christmas, snow on the ground and cold for this hunt we're talking about, or early season mild temperatures, so just in about 2 or 3 weeks from now.
Oh, well, if it's 2 or 3 weeks from now, boy, all of it. But when you started to say early season, I was thinking maybe like September for some prairie chickens or something. I do that. I really enjoy walking out in the prairie with the dog makes things even better.
Okay.
But I like snow too. I don't know. I don't know that I can choose really. It just depends on when I have time. I'll take either one.
Yeah. Okay. Hard to choose. All right. Question number six. September, you're on a dove hunt. Maybe you got one of your girls with you. Are you going to go park on a windmill with a water tank, or are you going to go sit on the edge of a grain stubble field where you've seen some birds moving?
Tell you what, I've tried both. Primarily, I have the most success around water in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I usually find a pond with some open shoreline, and I've done that 2 years in a row with that. Well, she's five now. She wouldn't have been five at the time, but mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't mind. She likes to get down and play in the mud and everything, and that's perfect. It doesn't affect the doves at all, so yeah, mm-hmm. I'll take the water source.
Okay. I think you just answered number seven, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Chickens in September or early teal?
Chickens, yep. Okay. Yeah, but I like walking in the prairie.
So just for our listeners, when we say chickens, we're talking about the Greater Prairie Chicken, which has a season in Kansas that starts in September. Yeah, we're not raiding somebody's hen house out on the farm.
Yeah, not my Rhode Island Reds.
Good to clarify. Good to clarify.
Okay, so the final question, number eight. What gauge of shotgun? Are you a 12-gauge guy, a 20-gauge? Maybe you're more obscure and carrying a 16 or a 28?
You know, I may be a product of circumstance and my upbringing and everything else, but I've got a 12 gauge. My wife has a 20 gauge, but I've never owned anything besides a 12 gauge. I'd like to try some other, you know, shotguns, over time, but, I still have the same shotgun that I bought in either high school or early college. And it's just a cheap mm-hmm. one from the store. So, yep, I've got a 12 gauge and I'm able to find a way to make that work for pretty much anything. I'm
pretty versatile.
Yep. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
That's right.
I like that. Simplicity is key. That's so great. Well, Brian, thank you for hopping on here with us and sharing all your wisdom and expertise in this field. I'm excited to have you back on again to talk more about special hunt opportunities. And quite frankly, you could probably just really break this down a little bit farther and share some really incredible resources for our listeners. But I know you mentioned earlier, if anyone's looking to get in touch with a biologist or a land manager, it's a quick Google search or whatever search of preference you want. But if anyone needs to contact you, where can they reach you at?
Yeah, so I'm out of the Hayes Regional Office for Wildlife mm-hmm. and Parks, which is it's right across from Gross Memorial Coliseum at Fort Hayes, right on the bypass there. And I can also be, you can Google the Hayes Regional Office and find the number and call me there. You could probably find my information online and everything. But yeah, if you just want to stop in and chat or ask some questions, feel free to come by the Hayes office and we'll get you sorted out.
Yeah, right. Well, I strongly encourage our listeners to do that. Brian, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks, Rob. Thanks, Brittany. I really appreciate you having me on here.
You bet. And we'll see you guys later.
We'll see y'all next time.